Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Francavilla Show. I'm your host, Dr. Carolyn Francavilla, board-certified family physician and diplomate of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. I've been helping patients lose weight to treat and prevent medical problems for the last 10 years, and I'm taking what I've learned from them to you. In this podcast, you will learn the science behind why you struggle with your weight and what to do about it, tips for common challenges, work to fight bias about what a healthy weight really is, and improve your relationship with food and your body. Please remember that while I'm a doctor, I'm not your doctor. This podcast is meant to be informational in nature only, not medical advice. Please seek out care from your physician for your specific needs. Okay, let's get started. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Dr. Francavilla Show. Today, I have a guest, and we are talking about the topic of PCOS, or polycystic ovarian syndrome. And this is actually a really common condition. So if you have not heard of it, I invite you to listen to this episode. I think you'll learn a lot. You may discover that some of these symptoms resonate with you or with someone you love, and learning more about this condition may be really eye-opening for you today. So I'd like to welcome my guest, Dr. Basma Ferris. She is a board-certified OBGYN and a certified culinary medicine specialist. She started her career as a registered dietitian over 20 years ago, and she now focuses her practice on caring for people with PCOS. So we have a ton to learn from our guests today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with a little bit more about you. How did you get interested in PCOS?
Sure. With my nutrition background, I've been seeing people with PCOS for a long time because people with PCOS have been referred to me when I was a practicing registered dietitian, either for having prediabetes or having weight concerns, wanting to lose weight. And so that was really the jumping off point for me starting to care for people with PCOS. And when I became an OBGYN, that just sort of naturally folded into my practice, right? So people were coming to me either diagnosed or not diagnosed with PCOS, oftentimes not diagnosed, coming for problems like menstrual irregularities or, you know, or difficulty getting pregnant. And then finding through diagnostics they had PCOS, and then is able to incorporate my nutrition knowledge to help them. So really, it's a natural meshing of my two parts of my brain, as I like to say.
Yeah, sounds like exactly what you were made to be doing. So let's talk about what PCOS is, and you know, what are some of the signs, symptoms, how someone might know if they have it.
So PCOS stands for polycystic ovarian syndrome, and it's kind of a confusing name, and there is some movements to try and change the name, because really what that is describing is an appearance on ultrasound of the ovaries where there are lots of follicles that haven't ruptured, they haven't ovulated. So they sort of line up around the periphery of the ovary, and the ovaries become enlarged, and they have lots of these really small cysts called follicles contained in them. And that's where the name came from. They're not really the type of cysts that cause people a lot of pain that people need surgical removal for. So sometimes people will think, oh yeah, I've had cysts a few times. That means I have PCOS. No, it's not that at all. And for somebody to be diagnosed with PCOS, there's a criteria that is now almost universally used called the Rotterdam criteria. And people need to make the diagnosis, they need to have two out of the three criteria. So one of the criteria is having that appearance on ultrasound, that polycystic appearance on ultrasound. And now there's an alternative. There's a blood test that can be used as an alternative to ultrasound called anti-Müllerian hormone, or AMH. And if that's elevated, that's a surrogate marker for having polycystic ovaries. The second criteria would be having skipping periods, having long menstrual cycles, or any other evidence of not ovulating. It's an ovulation disorder. So if you ovulate late or you don't ovulate at all, that's an ovulatory dysfunction, and that will result in irregular periods, late periods, and difficulty getting pregnant. And then lastly, signs or symptoms of having elevated androgens. And so these will be things like having cystic acne, having facial hair or chest hair, or having male pattern hair loss. And then something that isn't in the criteria, but since we're going to sort of transition into talking about the overlap of PCOS and obesity, is that although not part of the diagnostic criteria, the majority of people with PCOS have insulin resistance and are more likely to have obesity than people who don't have PCOS. And so when people who have PCOS have obesity, they also tend to have more of a male pattern in their fat distribution, or an android fat distribution, right? So when, and I'm sure you see this in your practice, there's some people whose fat is distributed right more along their hips and their thighs, and they have more subcutaneous fat. And then there are some people are more like an apple on little, right? On little twig legs, right? And so more of a and that has to do with the androgens.
Wow. Okay. So that's a lot of signs for someone to look out for sure. And ultimately, if any of those things sound, you know, fit with someone you know or yourself, seeing a physician, an OBGYN, or possibly your primary care physician, your family doc, to get these tests done to confirm, you know, if this is what's going on or not. But I find, I'm sure you've seen this, so many women who do not get this diagnosis until they've had symptoms for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years sometimes. Yeah. And then once they discover it, they're like, aha, like everything makes sense. How did I not know what was going on with my hormones and PCOS?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's incredibly frustrating to me because I feel like the criteria are pretty clear to make the diagnosis, yet women and people with PCOS have that experience where they're not diagnosed for several years. They're sort of dismissed and confused, and it's frustrating for me. So thanks for having me, because this helps me to, you know, to
yeah,
educate.
That's what I'm all about, right? I think knowledge is power. So, you know, if people
yep,
know what
exactly.
To look for, then they can move forward and make change. So there is this relationship between PCOS and weight. Let's talk about that. What is that relationship?
Yeah. So people with PCOS are twice as likely to have obesity than people without. So that's a pretty high number. And it is, you know, unfortunately, it's often been thought that it was the excess weight that was driving the PCOS, or the excess fat that was driving the PCOS, when in most circumstances, it's the opposite, right? It's the insulin resistance that's part of PCOS. Again, like I said, at least 75% of people with PCOS have insulin resistance. So it's the insulin resistance that's driving the weight gain and making it difficult to lose weight. And so, unfortunately, many people with PCOS have had negative experiences in that they were just told to, if you go lose weight, your PCOS is going to get better, right? Without giving a lot of resources or help. And so that is sort of a frustrating place to be if you have PCOS.
Yeah, yeah. There's this like chicken and egg thing, right? Like, you know, like for everything we see with diseases related to weight, where, you know, once you have it, like the weight makes it kind of worse in some ways.
Worse.
Without
Correct.
Fixing, you know, something like PCOS or diabetes or whatever's causing the weight, also going to be very hard to lose weight.
Correct. So yes, exactly. It's this spiral that, or this circle that people get caught up in, because certainly having excess body weight then exacerbates PCOS, right? We know having excess body weight, excess body fat worsens insulin resistance and worsens chronic inflammation. And so those two things make PCOS worse. So it is this sort of terrible, you know, sort of complicated situation that people with PCOS can find themselves in.
But it's also probably worth noting that not everyone who has PCOS has overweight or has obesity. People with all body types can have PCOS, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so people fall into what's called lean PCOS, but really it's just PCOS can exist across the spectrum of body sizes and body types. And that has unfortunately led to patients of mine who have normal weight being told that they need to lose weight by different healthcare professionals. And that is not necessarily the best advice, right? And so that can lead to other problematic behaviors, disordered eating, et cetera. And that's certainly, we don't want to be,
and just that
we want to be
feeling of
helping people, right? Like not making it worse.
Blaming yourself too, when you're like, oh, if I just did this thing, when at the end of the day, it's a diseased state, right? It's something that's not functioning normally in your body. And so there may be things you can do to improve that, right? But that doesn't mean that it's your fault. And it doesn't mean that there's not just also, we need to accept that it's a medical condition. And sometimes we just need to do things medically too, to solve the problem.
Correct. Yes. So there are medications that we can use to treat various aspects of PCOS. And then nutrition also has a very large role. And so, you know, we want to use all the tools in our toolbox, the same way that we treat obesity, right? We want to use all, we have many different tools and we want to use them.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about it. So I don't know where you want to start with, which tools you want to talk about. We talked about medications, nutrition. Let's talk about the nutrition, because it sounds like that is like your zone of genius and your expertise. So what are some of the nutritional strategies that actually make sense for PCOS?
So when I think about PCOS, I think about what is driving PCOS, right? And so you've got the elevated androgens that drive many of the symptoms, the irregular menstruation and the dermatologic symptoms, right? The facial hair and the acne. And there's very little that we can do. There are a few things, but not that many things that we can do from a nutrition standpoint to alleviate that. And so we have to focus on the other two, which are going to be low-grade chronic inflammation and insulin resistance. So much in the very, probably many overlaps to how we treat obesity and other conditions of metabolic syndrome. And that's going to be, if we're looking to help manage insulin resistance, that's going to be moderating refined carbohydrates, increasing fiber intake, just crafting our meals in such a way that we feel satiated. So when making sure that the meals really have not that are well-rounded and have different food groups. So what I'll tell people is if they want to plan a plate, they should try to include three things, and that's a plant, a protein, and a fat. And there's different, you know, people will use different strategies, but I feel like that sort of simplifies it. I see sometimes there are these different plans and these PCOS plates, and they have like six different things on the plate. And I'm like, that's too complicated for every single meal, right? That's a lot to try to accomplish. But if you can accomplish making sure you get a plant, a protein, and a healthy fat, then that's going to be a well-balanced, satiating meal that's not going to raise blood glucose too high, that's going to make people feel satisfied. And so there's all different strategies, and we can get into the nitty-gritty about why planning a plate as such is going to be satiating and helping with insulin resistance. Certainly, just how we time meals, how we time snacks. And that's going to be very individualized, because some people can tolerate longer stretches without eating and some people don't, right? That's why some people do well with things like time-restricted feeding and other people can't do it at all. And that may be because they've, So, and some people can't, right? And so it's not, right? I feel like everybody is told that they should be doing this thing, which is time-restricted feeding. It's not for everybody. Some people just don't have very large appetites. They need to eat more frequently. They have smaller stomachs. They need to eat more frequent meals. Some people have very high levels of circulating insulin, especially when they're first starting on this journey. And so they end up having episodes of hypoglycemia, which is really going to work against them, right? If your blood sugar is low, you're going to feel anxious and you're going to feel this real, you like need to eat and have worse cravings. So that's something that's going to be sort of tailored. And then if we're talking about how are we going to work to improve or reduce chronic inflammation, we want to really include a lot of anti-inflammatory foods. So that's going to be all different classes of fruits and vegetables, all the different colors with all the different phytochemicals. We want to be choosing healthy fats that have enough omega-3. So that's going to be nuts. That's going to be seafood. If you eat seafood, seaweed, there's a lot of different ways to get adequate omega-3s, making sure we get all of our antioxidant vitamins and making sure that we're avoiding certain foods and even household chemicals, talking about, endocrine disrupting chemicals that are present in food containers. And so there's so many different ways of really, if we really are doing an audit of somebody's lifestyle, that we can find to combat chronic inflammation.
You know, I haven't had anyone who's talked about the endocrine disruptors yet on my podcast. Do you mind talking a little bit more about that concept?
Sure. And I am not an expert in per se, but especially for the case of PCOS, there has been association, especially with BPA, and that comes from certain plastics. And so when we're looking at the type of food containers that you may use, how are you reheating your food? Have you been in this habit of reheating your food in plastics, right? And that may be something that we want to change, because those plastics can be released, you know, the BPA can be released into the food when heated. Not putting your plastics in the dishwasher, right? So if you do use any plastics, I do sometimes. I have cutting boards that, you know, have plastics, right?
Possible to completely avoid plastic.
Eliminate
in the modern
exactly.
world. Yeah.
But try to not heat them, wash them by hand, not put them in the dishwasher. And then thinking about if you're somebody who eats out a lot, and what the food containers that your restaurant or your takeout restaurant is utilizing. As we know, some have gone switched over to more like paper products, but some still, here where I live, still use plastic. And they're putting the hot food into the plastic containers, right? And so is that a source of BPA that you are being exposed to continuously? Certain fragrances in household products. So, you know, I know some people love their houses to smell like gingerbread during Christmas, but you got to think about all these different plugins and whatnot that we're using. And are we exposing ourselves to endocrine disruptors from all these different synthetic fragrances?
So I'm going to have to get a guest to go into some of these topics, because I think these are really important things.
Yeah, this is a fascinating.
I think, you know, it also goes to the, like, why do we have more insulin resistance? Why do we have so many people with type 2 diabetes? Why do we have so many people with PCOS? And we can blame the modern diet, but it may not always be all about the food, right? There are other things in our environment, from the items we cook with, the lining on the pans we cook with, to the things we're storing and heating our food in, to the fragrances and cosmetics we use that may be having an impact on our health too. So, well, we've given people maybe an insight into that. And yeah, that is something I'm going to have to find a guest to explore more on this podcast. So I think if I were to summarize some of what you said on nutrition, making more of your own food where you have more control over how it's prepared would be a key point. I didn't hear anything suggesting packaged food. So eating fresh, real food is probably a good talking point that's less processed, and getting healthy fats in, getting vegetables and other plants in with most of our meals, and keeping our meals lower glycemic. So not these really starchy carbs, which are usually the processed things, right? The chips, the crackers, the cookies, the breads that can kind of spike blood sugar are sort of the things that someone with PCOS should be intentional about eating.
Yes, correct. And if you are, you know, sometimes there's a cultural food you want to eat, or food you happen to, that you, you know, I love pasta, love it. And I don't love all the different alternative pastas. I just have to just say it, right? I've tried them all. There's some that are
I love the chickpea pasta. But I'll admit, I'm a big fan of the chickpea pasta.
They're okay. But sometimes, you know, you just want to have the real thing. And so the way to do that is making sure that you're including vegetables. So I'll make a lot of, you know, I'll make pasta meal that really has a lot of vegetables. The vegetables in it will provide the fiber that's not being provided there for a whole grain. So just learning ways that you can change what you are doing, right? It doesn't mean that you have to all of a sudden start eating foods or eating flavors that are not comfortable for you, that are not things that you love, but how do we take what you're doing and what you love and makes you happy and makes taste buds happy, makes your mouth happy, and just make it better for you? And so that's really my strategy. But yes, home cooking is a big part of it, because even if you make choices based on some ingredients on a menu, you really don't know what is it being cooked in, what are the different seasonings that are being added to it, and again, and you know, how is it being packaged? And so you don't have full control when you aren't making food yourself. So I help people to just through culinary medicine, I provide recipes and tips how people can start incorporating, you know, more home prepared meals, even if they're not very skilled in the kitchen, and giving people confidence so they can increase their confidence to help take care of themselves, right? I think it's just an important life skill to know how to feed yourself.
Yes. Yeah. I love it. Okay. And then what about sort of the medication side? What medications can be helpful for someone who has PCOS?
So it's going to depend on what people's goals are and what their symptoms are. So if we're talking about some of the more the dermatologic or androgenic symptoms, then we may be using something like spironolactone, and that can help with acne and facial hair. If we're talking about managing somebody's regular menstruation, it's going to really depend on whether or not they are intending pregnancy or they're seeking contraception. And so oral contraceptives have been used for a long time to manage PCOS, and they should be. But there's a lot of unnecessary controversy or backlash around the use of oral contraceptives for PCOS. And I think that really comes from the lack of information that is provided at the time of diagnosis. If people are really given a good explanation of what their diagnosis is, what PCOS is, and why oral contraceptives may be helpful to them, then I think that's very different than just saying you have PCOS, here, go on the pill and come back when you want to get pregnant, that's what happened historically. And then people also have to know that there are alternatives to oral contraceptives. If they say that's not what I want, what else can I do? There are alternatives. So oral contraceptives treat two things when it comes to PCOS. Number one, when people don't ovulate regularly, their uterus gets exposed to too much estrogen and then not enough progesterone. And over time, over the course of years, this increases a person's risk of endometrial cancer. And that is why most of us feel strongly about having some sort of balance to that, some sort of counter to that. And oral contraceptives is one way of accomplishing that. The other thing that oral contraceptives accomplish is that it's very effective in improving those symptoms, the facial hair, the acne. And so because of the hormones in the pill, increase this protein in our blood called sex hormone binding globulin. And this is this protein that binds to our hormones. And if you have more of that protein, it can bind to more of the testosterone in your blood and help to treat some of these symptoms. So that's why many doctors like to use oral contraceptives, because it's actually solving two problems at once. If you're somebody who can't take estrogen, or if you don't need contraception, or for whatever reason you are dead set against taking the pill, because there are some downsides, then there are alternatives. So people can take progesterone in sort of a cyclic fashion. If they don't get their menstrual period for 2 months, they can take a course of progesterone, and that will help to protect their endometrium from developing endometrial cancer. So it is not that oral contraceptives are the only game in town. They just are useful because they do provide two benefits, whereas some of the other treatments don't, and then you may need to use more than one medication. And so it's really going to depend on what somebody's goals are and what else they have going on with their PCOS. So, and then last, you know, we talked about insulin resistance already. Many times people, even though they're doing all the different things that we talked about with regard to their nutrition, and they're being physically active, which is very important for helping insulin resistance, they need medication. Usually our first go-to is metformin. Mm-hmm. Many people don't tolerate or don't want to take metformin for whatever reason. Some people can have gastrointestinal side effects. And so many people use a supplement called inositol, which has been shown to improve insulin resistance with similar efficacy to metformin. And then there are other anti-hyperglycemic agents. And then there are the GLP-1 agonists, of which you are very familiar with, you know, using.
Yeah, I like do the prescribe Wegovy them
sometimes. Exactly. Less, I don't prescribe them very often because I think there are other people that do that, you know, have a bit more nuanced experience than I do. And so in terms of all the different options that there are now, but that's certainly something that we can use as well. So there's a lot of different options now for people to manage all of their different symptoms. And we can, you know, customize to whatever somebody's particular brand of PCOS, because it's a syndrome. So everybody's PCOS is going to look a little bit different.
Yeah. And I don't think we talked about this, but I got to do a presentation a few years ago, actually, for OBGYNs, some DO OBGYNs. And when I did a deep dive into PCOS, you know, sometimes we just think of something as one thing, but there's actually a bunch of different phenotypes of PCOS, right? So there's actually a bunch of different types of PCOS. Yeah. It's not just one thing. It's kind of saying, you know, like, I have cancer. Well, do you have breast cancer? Do you have skin cancer? What type of cancer, right? Like, PCOS isn't all the same. So your PCOS symptoms may be different than your friend's PCOS symptoms because there are different
types sister's.
Of PCOS. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think sometimes we get lumped in. So then if we hear something, we're like, well, I don't have that. You know, it doesn't mean that it's not the right diagnosis. You don't have to have all of the symptoms. You may not get the acne, right? That may not be
correct
for PCOS symptom, or that may be the worst part of your PCOS. And so you may be only focused on treating that and you don't need to worry as much about your periods maybe or something. So I think it's important to realize all these things look different for different people.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, what else didn't we cover that listeners should know about PCOS and weight? I guess we didn't really talk about, you know, does weight loss help with PCOS? And if so, how much weight would someone need to lose in order to see a benefit from PCOS?
Sure. So I think, you know, you may agree with me on this. Studies have shown that modest weight loss improves PCOS symptoms. And so whenever we talk about modest weight loss, we talk about somewhere in the ballpark of 5 to 10% of body weight, right? That's usually what the literature says. I always sort of question whether or not the weight loss is a, or the weight change, whether or not it's a surrogate marker for the changes in other, either processes that are going on in the body or behaviors that have been changed, because many of the ways that we manage PCOS in terms of, you know, from a nutrition standpoint, from a lifestyle standpoint, right? Nutrition, fitness, sleep are the same ways in which we manage obesity, right? So they're very similar, whether somebody is obese or not, if they have PCOS, many of those changes will still apply.
Yeah. So I think to say eating the healthier way, increasing movement, getting good sleep, all the things that someone might do if they were trying to lose weight, doing those things, even if you didn't lose weight, might also help the PCOS, right?
Correct. Like
doing the lifestyle things is usually worth doing, likely to improve your health, regardless of the change on the scale in many cases.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Saying it in the opposite way, that you may, and so you may lose weight as a result, or maybe the weight loss was the goal, and then we saw these other improvements. So I think it's, you know, overlying. And I don't think it's wrong in either way. I just think it's, what are we measuring when we measure that?
Yeah, I think I've talked about this on the podcast, but I suspect, you know, in the next decade, we're very slow in medicine, going to stop talking so much about weight and just that metabolic health, right? And so there are certain patterns of eating and increasing movement and medications that improve our metabolic health. And that is related to weight, but weight is not the most important number oftentimes in evaluating metabolic health. So yes, do the things that are healthy. And then if you see a change on the scale and you're happy about that, good for you. But if you just feel better and your symptoms are better, like, we maybe don't need to care that much about what the scale says as long as your health is better.
Yes. So that's the approach that I usually like to take, is that let's make the behavior changes, the goals, or maybe some other parameters, right? Some other biochemical measures, like maybe your cholesterol improves, maybe your A1C improves, maybe your inflammatory markers go down, and maybe those are better goals for us, especially somebody who maybe is, you know, has a history of weight loss and regain, or somebody who has a history of disordered eating, or, you know, has some body dysmorphia, then that may especially be a better way of approaching our health goals than just using weight as the metric. And so, yeah, I agree with you. I think as we understand metabolic health better, we will hopefully have some better measures of how we can improve that. And I think just up until now, we just have continually used weight or BMI as our outcome in research. And that's what we as physicians who rely on evidence and want to practice evidence-based medicine, then we conflate that as the goal. And so I hope that, yeah, we'll have a bit more of a sophisticated understanding of our metabolic health.
I love it. Well, if people would like to learn more from you, where can they find you? How can they connect with you? What else do you do?
Well, I'm on social media. I love to just share when I can, when I have the time to do so, to educate the public. And if people want to work with me, you know, more closely, I have a telemedicine practice. I am licensed only in New York or Florida. So if you live in New York and Florida and you want some guidance with your PCOS, you could please reach out and see me. And I also have a, for everybody else, I have a patient course, which is like, it's a labor of love. It is chock full. It's 28 different lessons. So 28 days of information about PCOS, from nutrition to what medications might we use and the pros and cons of each, to supplements, to what labs do we use to diagnose PCOS, and, you know, what are the labs that you may want to ask your doctor for. It's really very thorough, very detailed, but in a way that's, you know, easy for people to understand who aren't healthcare professionals. And so that is available as well.
Where can people find that?
So the course is at PolyPrep, P-O-L-L-Y, prep.com.
Great.
And the telemedicine is PolyPrepMD.com. But the course, like I said, it's chock full. It gives you access to all the courses, and there are recipes in there and shopping lists and cooking videos, and there's a secure group chat. So we have a little community, and, you know, it's really inexpensive.
So we'll make sure that PolyPrep is in the show notes so people can find that. And Dr. Veras, thank you so much for joining us. We had awesome conversation, lots of ideas there.
Thank you for all that you do, both for patients and for other physicians. Really, you're a fantastic resource. I really appreciate you, and I appreciate you having me on here.
Oh, well, thank you for your kind words. And until next week, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Dr. Francavilla Show, where we learn about all things related to weight and health. If you love this podcast, make sure to leave those 5-star reviews and share this podcast with a friend or loved one. If you have a topic about weight and health you want me to tackle, head over to the website, thedrfrancavillashow.com, to submit your question. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss next week's episode. Take care.